Hi, my name is Vince, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Vince.
Thank you for inviting us here this weekend. This is a privilege and an honor, and it always is when I'm invited to do this, and I want you to know that I know that, and that I consider it an honor, and I thank you for inviting me, and I thank you for inviting Pat and I down here. We've had a marvelous weekend so far. We feel like we've had a weekend already, and it's just Friday. We got here yesterday afternoon, and the committee was so gracious and so wonderful, and it's just been a lovely experience up to now. And I know the rest of the weekend will be marvelous as well, because I know some of the people who follow me this weekend, and they're all just wonderful, wonderful speakers. So if tonight you are, if I induce you into a fit of ennui, come back later, because better things are in store. I know that there are many new people here tonight, and I would like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And incidentally, that is where you are tonight. You're in AA, which is really grim, isn't it? I mean, who in the hell bargained for that? You know, I mean, good grief. And if you are new tonight, I can tell you that most of us here who have been here a while have never met you, but we know all about you. We know, for example, that down deep in your soul, if you're anything at all like us, you are utterly convinced that you are not really alcoholic, that you don't belong here, and that your case is different. And we would like you to know that if you do in fact feel that way, the very fact that you feel that way means that you are precisely like us and that you indeed do belong here. We also know that you will find this experience fraught with paradox. Nothing will make a whole lot of sense. It is completely and totally illogical. And you will find us very confusing. We will contradict each other all the time. For example, you have joined a group of people who admittedly cannot manage their own lives, but will be delighted to take yours on. And hopefully, you are desperate enough tonight to allow them to do it. That is the prescription in Alcoholics Anonymous, as it turns out. It is desperation. The ingredient that you need inside of you to make it here. And I hope that you have it if you are new tonight. I know that I will describe my first AA meeting to you, which was a very long time ago now. It was in November of 1965. I know, girls. I know. Hard to believe that I am that old. I understand that. The truth is, I'm really not. I was only seven at that meeting. It was in the basement of a Presbyterian church in Long Beach on a very cold and rainy November night in 1965. And it was in the Los Altos section of Long Beach, which at least at that time was a very upscale part of the town. It was a upper middle class community, and it was really the AA event. The AA event in Long Beach was the Los Altos meeting on Friday night. And you must remember, in 1965, there wasn't an AA meeting on every corner, and this was the big deal. Everybody got dressed up on Friday night, and they came to this AA meeting. It was a real big, enthusiastic, exciting speaker meeting, and everybody there looked good, and they sounded good, and they were really at their best on Friday night. And the overwhelming perception that I had sitting in that room is that no one in that room looked alcoholic. Nobody looked like what I thought an alcoholic ought to look like. They all looked like they had tightly wrapped, well-ordered lives. You know what I mean? Like there wasn't anything really wrong with them. And if you were to wander into that room on that Friday night or any given Friday night, and someone were to say to you, you are in a room filled with alcoholics, pick one out. You wouldn't have picked anybody. Oh, you'd pick me on the night I was there, on that night. Because I had on a filthy t-shirt and a ripped pair of jeans. I had not shaved nor bathed in over a week. And I'd spent the previous 5 days in the Long Beach City Jail due to a series of unfortunate circumstances that were not clearly my fault. The police department in Long Beach is fascist. And they had abused my civil rights on a regular basis in those days. And I would end up in the Long Beach City Jail. And that's what I ended up in. And I had no job, no car, no money. And every time I get in that kind of shape, I go to AA. And that's why I was there. My motivation was simply no better than that. So if you're new here tonight and you fear your motivation is not noble, I have good news for you. We do not evaluate you as to your motivation here. If we did, this would be a smaller meeting. Go to the bank on that. So it's only important that you're here. And I sat in the back of the room where most new people sit, up against the wall. And I should also tell you that I'm Irish and Catholic, and I'm from New Jersey. It's all right. Usually that gets booed. Great. And I have difficulty with people from Texas. You know, we have a chemistry problem, you know what I mean? It's just never have really connected. And I sat next to this guy who was about 6'5", and he had on cowboy boots and a 10-gallon hat in his lap, and his name was Tex. And Tex was not sober very long himself, and he wanted to hit me. And he told me, he said, boy, I'm going to hip you. And I remember thinking, Jesus, you know, go hip somebody else. You know, just, Christ, leave me alone. But he was going to hip me. And the first thing he did is he repeated to me in rapid succession all of the AA cliches, one after another. And they are dreary, aren't they? Really, if you're, I mean, good God, you know. I listened to them and I thought, Jesus, you know, easy does what? You know, and he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, I keep it simple. I thought, oh, I'll bet you do, Tex. I have no argument with that, let me tell you. And he gave me a handful of pamphlets. And on top of the pamphlets was a card with the 20 questions on it. And almost everybody here is familiar with that. The test we give you if you're new, devised by the medical school at Johns Hopkins. And they've decided they can tell who is an alcoholic and who isn't by the way you answer these 20 questions. And that may or may not be true. But I can tell you what, if some old timer gives you this test to take, take it. It pleases them. And that's a good reason to take the test. They treat you better. And so I took this test for Tex. And the criteria is if you answer, you don't want to answer yes if you don't want to belong here. Because the more yes answers you have in these 20 questions, the more alcoholic you get. The first, if you answer one question yes, you may have a drinking problem. If you answer two questions yes, you do have a drinking problem. Three or more, and you are an alcoholic. So I took this test for Tex, and I answered about 16 or 18 of these questions, yes. I remember I answered no to the question, do you seek lower companions? I could not find any. You know, where the hell do you go after the Long Beach City Jail? So it really is a meaningless exercise for me, but it might mean something to you, so take it. And the meeting began, and it began in precisely the same way we began here this evening. They read essentially what is our program, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you are new here tonight, that's it. If you are to recover here, it is required that you take them. It is not merely suggested. That is a bold-faced lie. It's required. If you take them, you get better. If you do not take them, you get worse. And you get worse while you sit sober in the middle of AA. I think we owe you that information if you're new. You ought to know that now, because there is no requirement for membership here. There is, however, a huge requirement for recovery. And that is those 12 steps. Now, I sat in the back of that room and I listened to them read. And I don't know about you, but I didn't hear anything new. Nothing new. I am the end product of 8 years of Dominican nuns and 4 years of Jesuit priests. And I will tell you, there is nothing new here. All of it is concepts and principles that are well familiar to me. It is part of the religious tradition in which I was raised, in which I practiced, and I know all about it. These are not new concepts to AA. They're not unique to Alcoholics Anonymous. Searching and fearless moral inventory is not new, let me tell you. In the tradition in which I was raised, we have a different name for it. We called it examination of conscience. Precisely the same exercise. Admitting to God and to another human being the exact nature of your wrongs is not new. I did it from the time I was 7 years old every Saturday afternoon until the time I was 16. I know about this. And it certainly has nothing to do with the way that I drink. If this was my answer, certainly I would not have to come to a Presbyterian church, I tell you, and sit. You know, I can see where it might help you if you're undereducated and Protestant. I mean, I understand it. But I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that my case is different. So sitting in the back of that room on that rainy Friday night, somewhere in my subconscious, I made a decision. I didn't reason it all out, and I didn't think about it consciously, but somewhere in my heart, in my mind, in the back of the deepest recesses of my mind, I made a decision. And that decision was, my case is different. I am not like you. It does not apply to me. And the meeting continued. And there were several people who participated, and they were nice people, and they said innocuous things that were clearly inapplicable to my life, but they were nice people who apparently drank too much, went to AA, and went on back to being nice people. So I said to Tex, where do you send the more difficult cases? Because there's more wrong with me. And he said, shut up, something, you know, equally articulate. And if I had any doubts as to whether I belonged there or not, they were cured at the end of the meeting when they had birthday parties. I mean, really, you know, good God. Birthday parties, for, you know, some moron who went a year without taking a drink. They gave him a cake with a candle. I mean, good, you know, it was really embarrassing. It's like something that should take place in a mental institution, you know, right in the day room, you know, right before dance therapy, or after you've worked on your ashtray, you know, we'll have birthday parties for the alcoholics, you know. And they had a number of these parties, and one in particular for this woman who was about 110, and she was in a fire on top of this cake. She was sober forever. And she came down the aisle to blow the candles out, and I didn't know whether it was, you know, whether pulmonary disease would get her before she got the candles out, but she She got him out, and she got up here, and she said her name was Phoebe, and that she was an alcoholic. And then she said something about, did I want what she had? Not tonight, Phoebe. I don't think so. Now, that was my first AA meeting. And I think you could safely say that I did not have a spiritual awakening. But I will tell you what I did. For the next 3.5 years, I stayed sober right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And during that period of time, I participated in AA on virtually every level. I did everything there was to do in AA. I had every kind of a commitment you could possibly have. I folded chairs and set up meetings and made coffee and emptied scrubbed ashtrays. Did everything there was to do in AA, except one thing. I did not take these steps. And as a result, my alcoholism got worse. And it got worse while I stayed sober right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are people here tonight who are precisely in that state of mind and body. You've been here some appreciable length of time. You are not involved in these steps, and you're getting worse. And you know you're getting worse. And the way you know you're getting worse is you are surrounded by people who are getting better. And you know they're getting better. There are no secrets here. Everybody knows who everybody is. And the way you know they're getting better is they have something you don't have. You don't know quite what it is, but you know you don't have it. And you can see it in them. It's visual, isn't it? Isn't recovery here visual? Does anyone ever have to come up to you and say, hey, I'm recovered? Doesn't happen, does it? You just need to be around them. And they have people who are getting better here, they have a sense about them. They have a sense of purpose. Their life has direction. There's something happens to their face, their eyes. It all changes. And if you're like me, you sit here and you look at that and you say, when does that happen to me? When in the hell does that happen to me? I used to think you had secret meetings. Have you ever had that feeling? They didn't tell you where they were, and they all met, and they shared, you know. Intellectually, that's ridiculous, but emotionally and psychologically, I think that's how I felt. And that's how I functioned in AA. I got worse, and they got better. And on the outside, good things happened to me. I got a wonderful job. I should tell you, I come from a wonderful, magnificent, loving family. It's huge, and it's Irish, and it's Catholic, and there are no other alcoholics in it. How's that for heresy in AA? They're all disgustingly normal. They're wonderful. I mean, they really are. I am the fifth child in a family of 5 kids. I have 4 older sisters. My youngest sister is 11 years older than I am. I was born in 19... My father was 50 and my mother was 45 when I was born in 1940. And along came this boy and this big Irish family with all these girls, and I must tell you, the prince had arrived. I mean, I was there, and my sisters took care of, I mean, they fought over who would babysit me and take me out with them on dates, and I mean, oh, it was during the war, they dressed me in soldier suits and sailor suits and pictures saluting the flag, and would make you throw up. It's awful, you know. And they just loved me, and just, I mean, my father just was so crazy about me. He never said a cross word to me till the day he died. He just loved me so much. My earliest recollections of Christmas are my father in my bedroom in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve, kneeling down beside the bed, waking me up, and he would say, I just saw the sleigh leave. Let's go downstairs. and the entire family would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go downstairs and have Christmas because my father couldn't wait. I was loved, I was nurtured, I was cared for, and I like to talk about that because I know I have been seated in AA meetings, and I have heard people describe the most horrible lives and awful ways that they had to grow up that it's literally made me weep. And I must tell you, that is not my experience. But it also tells me something else. It tells me that all of that, my experience or yours, has nothing to do with why we're here. It has nothing to do with who is or who is not an alcoholic. Because we come from everywhere here. From every kind of possible background, every kind of experience, and we're all here, sitting in this hotel on Good Friday night in San Diego with the same problem and the same answer. So, and I should also tell you that I am the product of a Roman Catholic education. You can't get more of a Roman Catholic education than me. I mean, you just can't. And I'm going to tell you something else. I was not tortured by nuns or warped by priests or given some evil fear of God. It did not happen to me. It's not my experience. What I received from the Roman Catholic Church is a spectacular education. In spite of myself, I was surrounded by clergy, men and women, who loved me, who cared for me, and saw to it that I got educated. My alcoholism is not the fault of the Roman Catholic Church, and neither is yours. Incidentally, if you are trying to hang it on them, I have news for you. They're not going to accept responsibility. I will also tell you, when you get around to taking that searching and fearless moral inventory that we demand that you take here, if you do it correctly, what happened to me, it is the worst news I ever got in my life. It's terrible news. My life is my fault. Not what I was looking for. I should also tell you that my parents died within 1 week of each other when I was 12 years old. My father had a massive heart attack on January the 3rd, 1953, and died, and my mother died a week later. She was sick. She had been ill ever since I was born, and she just couldn't continue without him, I guess. She just quit. And she died a week later, and we had these two big Irish wakes in the space of 1 week. And clearly, it was difficult for a 12-year-old kid to go through. There's no question about that. But I was surrounded by these four sisters who are now married, and they were two great guys. I mean, I love my brother-in-laws. It was all, I was surrounded by love and nurturing. So, I just moved on. I went to live with my uncle, however, who was an Irish bachelor. He was my mother's brother. He was 65. And I was 12. But I went to live with him. He was the patriarch of our family. He was also a politician in the state of New Jersey. He was mayor of Jersey City for 27 consecutive years. He was state chairman of the Democratic Party. And he decided that I was going to live with him. And when he made those kind of decisions, that's what happened. It's the way that it went. And he was going to undertake my education and he did. And we had a communications problem. He was 65 and I was 12. But he loved me, and I knew that he loved me. And now I should also, I want you to know that I am a very good student. I get A's. I am also what is known as a behavior problem. I get in trouble. I'm always in trouble. In every school I've ever been in, I've been thrown out of every one. I've never been in a school that I have not been expelled from for bad behavior, drinking, combination of both. And this started very early. I went to four different Jesuit prep schools. I was thrown out of the one I was in every year, and they would get me in another one. My senior year, I was due to graduate and give the address at graduation as valedictorian of my class. I did not get to give that address because I stole this priest's car and went joyriding in May. Graduation was in June, and they told me not to come to graduation. As a matter of fact, they said, if we ever have a class reunion, don't come to that either. Just forget about it. And I went on to school in upstate New York. I wanted to go to the University of Notre Dame, which is where you wanted to go if you came from the kind of tradition that I was raised in. Yeah, your speaker tomorrow night went to Georgetown. That's too bad. But I do think he went there when the Jesuits were still Catholic. So, but I wanted to go to Notre Dame. And my uncle did not want me to do that. He felt that I would be, I would need closer supervision when we go to school closer to home. So I ended up going up to Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and I resented that. I didn't want to go there, which shows you I was not spoiled. But that's where I went to school, and I spent every semester of undergraduate school on disciplinary probation in the 60s. I don't know if you know how hard that was to do. I mean, that was, you know, almost impossible. They were burning the campus down, and I'm drunk somewhere and in trouble. And I passed out drunk in snowbanks in February. People would leave me, you know, places, and I wouldn't know how to where I was or how to get home. And it was very cold in the winter in Ithaca, New York, and I had to be rescued a number of times. And I remember coming out of a blackout in a sorority house one morning at 5 a.m. in this young lady's room. I don't know what I was doing there. I suppose she needed to be tutored. I don't know. And that's the kind of the way my undergraduate experience was. In the middle of my senior year, I got in an argument with my uncle over money, and I showed him who was going to run my life. And it wasn't going to be him, and I quit school and joined the Navy. Now, I had a 3.8 GPA in biochemistry and was on track to go to medical school. And I left in the middle of my senior year to join the Navy as an enlisted man. I was a very bright kid. And because of my aspirations to go to medical school and my that undergraduate background, they sent me to hospital corps school to be a hospital corpsman. And I did very well in hospital corps school. I graduated number one, and they sent me to a more advanced medical school where they trained corpsmen to go on destroyers that did not have physicians, called independent duty school, far more sophisticated medical training. Graduated number one, did very well. They then sent me to a short course in medical administration, and then at the end of that school, they commissioned me an officer. They made me an ensign in the Medical Service Corps and attached me to the 3rd Marine Division on Okinawa, which was not in my plans. But I ended up on the island of Okinawa as a young ensign in the Medical Service Corps in the United States Navy, attached to the 3rd Marine Division as a medical administrative officer, and they couldn't find a job for me in the 5th Marines, the 5th Marine Regiment in the 3rd Marine Division. These are the guys that raised the flag on Iwo Jima. You know, these are... And me. And they couldn't find a job for me, so they put me in an officer's club on the northern end of Okinawa and forgot about me. And I forgot about them, quite frankly. My duty was I got up in the morning and reported to the cocktail lounge of this officer's club and drank Hagenhag Pinch, 60 cents a pop, which is not bad. That's pretty good. And pretty soon they up there, he was a surgeon out of Temple University, a thoracic surgeon, who was, they didn't want around patients because he was a terrible drunk. So they stuck him up in this officer's club. He's the only surgeon you've ever met that had an eagle on his arm tattooed. You know, this guy has marched to his own drummer. And they put him up in that officer's club. And he and I bonded. You know what I mean? We became brothers. And we both got up every day and reported to the cocktail lounge. And we kind of lost all our uniforms. We wore shorts and we grew beards and, you know, never put on a uniform and didn't know where they were. And we were talking about it earlier. The Marine Corps has a birthday celebration in November every year. They celebrate their birthday. And the regimental commander decided that all of the officers had to make a command performance at this party. And we didn't have any uniforms. You know, we had to scrounge up. And we showed up to this party. And the colonel looked at us and he said, who are those guys? You know, he'd never met us before, and we were two officers in his command. And he said, what do they do? And nobody could really give him an answer. So he said, give them a job. So the next day, we were put in charge of venereal disease control for the island of Okinawa. And our job was, these Marines would get venereal disease. They would get gonorrhea and syphilis and lymphogranuloma venereum, and they would get hideous venereal disease that you only saw in textbooks and in Marines. Yeah. Yeah. The only two places they were ever discovered. Yeah. And our job was to go out, and the Marines would have to say where they got, and our job was to go out in the villages, into the bars where the young ladies were, identify, locate the young ladies and inject them with bicillin, or, you know, just tawdry talk, isn't it? But that's what we did. And so that was our job. Now, we had this awesome power to quarantine these bars. You know, we could just close them up. So when they'd see us coming, they'd know we were coming, they would put up the Hague and Hague on the bar, free. So all we did was drive around this Jeep all over Okinawa and drink for free. And I am proud to tell you that we never quarantined one bar, ever. But it was tricky. You didn't want to drink too much in these bars because you want these girls to start looking good to you, for one thing. But you knew why you were there. So you walked a fine line. But that's what we did. And then our tour of duty was up, and we came back to the United States, and we got out. He went on back to Temple, completed his residency in cardiovascular surgery. He's now a cardiovascular surgeon in Philadelphia. And as far as I know, he's never been to AA. I guess if you need a bypass, stay the hell out of Philadelphia. I went on back up to Cornell and finished undergrad school and was accepted tentatively at a couple of medical schools, but they thought I had social problems, and was recommended that I go out and work for a while in the world and reapply. And I did then the next thing that most, all of you will identify with. What do you do when you come to that juncture in your life when you know that there's something wrong with you? You're not, you know, your peers are all doing better. Do you know what I mean? They're just, something's happening that's not happening to you. They're completing their education. They're beginning their careers. They're, you know, the answer is get married. That's what you do. You get married, and that will make you grow up. You get married. And so I got married, and I married a girl that I met in the Navy. She was a Navy nurse, and she was a beautiful girl. She was, but to say that we were incompatible is to really understate it. We never should have gone out twice, but we got married. And she got pregnant immediately, and we then moved to Southern California. I was going to go ahead and go to med school. I'd applied at UCLA and SC, and was probably going to go either place. And we moved in with her parents. She was an only child, and she was now pregnant with their only grandchild, and so it was all very exciting. And I got a stopgap summer job as a bartender, which turned out badly. I ended up showing up at 5 o'clock in the morning in various stages of undress and drunk, and, you know, and the long and short of it is she and her parents threw me out. And I ended up on Bolsa Avenue in Orange County with a lot of Samsonite luggage and very little money. And I got a job for the rest of that summer as an ambulance driver in Orange County. And for the rest of that summer, I drove an ambulance drunk. Now, I am a blackout drinker, which made many of those ambulance calls quite colorful. I have been on an ambulance calls with the lights and the sirens going down Broadway in Santa Ana, and I'd come out of a blackout, and I'd look around me, and I'd say to the attendant next to me, "Where are we going?" And that would really unnerve him, I'll tell you. He'd really get upset. I once came out of a blackout driving around a cul-de-sac in Costa Mesa in the middle of the night with the lights and going on top. You know, you lock onto something and you just can't get out of it. We're just going around this circle. The red light's beacon is going through this people's bedroom windows, and they're all coming out on their porch in their pajamas watching this ambulance go around the circle. And they had to actually send a police car into the cul-de-sac to lead me out. They really did. Just followed him out. Shortly thereafter, I lost my job. I also, as a side benefit, had my driver's license revoked forever in the state of California. And that's the package I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous on that rainy November evening. This is who came to AA. And with my newfound sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, many things happened. First of all, a new profession opened up in civilian medicine called the Physician's Assistant Program. What happened was that came to be, many of you know what PAs now are, but then it was brand new. And the reason for that profession to even come into existence was that in the late 60s, the medical schools, the guys coming out of the medical schools were all going into residencies and specializing, and there was a shortage of physicians in emergency rooms to do primary medicine. So the concept came into being that they would take people such as myself, who had this rather sophisticated medical training in the military, and we became the first PAs. As a matter of fact, I was the third licensed PA in the state of California, and I went to work in an emergency room in East Los Angeles, nights. And I got to tell you, that's really a busy place. I want you to know. What happened in that ER was all of the things that happened in an emergency room. And I was the guy in that ER at night. And I'll tell you what, it was a good job, and I was in on the ground floor of a new profession, and I really was, I did this well. I was well trained, and I functioned very well. And things went well. I mean, it was exciting. I met a girl, beautiful girl, daughter of a long-time sober AA member. And we fell in love, and we got married. And she went to Al-Anon. And I was in AA. We were precious, is what we were. We really were. We were that nice AA couple. You know, she's in Al-Anon and he's in AA, and it's all just going to be wonderful for them. Except I had not taken these steps. There was no spiritual recovery in my life. And I would go into this emergency room at night, and I would get terribly depressed. Awfully depressed. And I would get anxious, and I would get all of the things that you know about and I know about that happen to you when you're not drinking and you're unrecovered. All of those things. And I don't have a spiritual program, but I have an excellent medical education. So I know how to take care of depression. I use Dexedrine. 15 milligram spantials work best. And before I was through, I was taking 6 or 7 of those a day. Now, I don't know if you know anything about amphetamine abuse, but that will move you right on down the road. Boy, I'll tell you. Whatever you're doing, it will be quick. The problem... fourth day when you've not slept nor eaten, and you show up in the emergency room to help the sick. Your hair stands up on end like that, and your eyes dilate out and here like this. And if you're like me, you get this white crud that would come down here like that. And the guy you're relieving never wants to go home. You know, he looks at you and he says things like, "Vince, get some sleep. Get something to eat." But thank God for medical science, there's an anecdote for that. And that is a drug called Demerol. Oh, you know about Demerol. Demerol is not a true narcotic. Don't worry about it, though. You will never tell the difference. You won't know the difference. It's a synthetic, really. But it is in the class of narcotics. And I'm going to say something about that now. Narcotics are different than alcohol. They're not the same. Narcotic addiction and alcoholism are different. They are not the same. And the reason is this. Narcotics are addictive. They all come from the same place. They come from opium. Heroin, Dilaudid, it's all the same thing. Morphine, it's all really the same thing. And all narcotics are addictive. They are addictive psychologically and physiologically for everyone. Inject heroin, you will be addicted. Inject morphine, you will be addicted. That is not true with alcohol. Alcohol, as it turns out, we represent 1 out of 10 people who drink alcohol. The other 9 out of 10 people who drink alcohol do not have our experience. They are not alcoholic. They don't wreck cars. They don't go to jail. They don't burn up families. They are what is known as social drinkers. Now, I don't understand them. And they say things that are baffling, don't they, social drinkers? They say things like, "No more for me. I have to drive." Or, "I'd love to have another, but you see, my wife is waiting dinner. I'm going home now." "Not me, Jack. I am going to Las Vegas." I have yet to meet a social heroin user. So there's a difference. But having said that, I will also tell you that many of us here have used everything. And if you've used drugs other than alcohol, it does not make you less of an alcoholic. But in order to be an alcoholic, you must be an alcoholic. And in order to function here, you must be an alcoholic. Now, I began to use Demerol in this emergency room. Now, there's another very bad thing about Demerol. A very uncomfortable thing. People care about where it is. Yeah, really. It's accounted for, you know. And the people that come in the morning for the morning shift, and they open the narcotic drawer, and all the dope is gone. And they say things to you like, Vince, where is the Demerol? And I would say, I don't know. And everybody would get upset. The pharmacist who issues the narcotics would get crazy. And the administrators are a very flighty lot anyway. They overreact to everything. And they particularly would overreact to the missing Demerol. But the people who have the worst reaction to missing Demerol is the Medical Quality Assurance Board of the state of California. I can tell you about their reaction. They reacted so poorly that they came into that emergency room in the middle of the night one Thursday night and placed me under arrest, charged me with a felony appropriating narcotics for my own use, and took me to the Los Angeles County Jail. That was the then program for impaired physicians, by the way. This is pre-enlightenment. The program was the LA County Jail. And that's where we went, downtown, in my little green scrub suit, to the LA County Jail. And I'll tell you, and they put me in a tank with these hideous people who were clearly drug addicts. And they, in the morning, they let me out, and that charge was subsequently reduced to misdemeanor. I didn't have to go to jail, but I lost my medical license. And I ended up spending the summer. All of this came down to the summer of 1972, and I'll just tell you very briefly about that. That I spent the summer of 1972 living in an apartment by the airport in Englewood, drinking 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. I need not tell you anything else. You know this story. And it's just, when you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day, incidentally, you are an alcoholic. No, social drinking, that's not social drinking under anybody's definition. And the things that happen to me happen to anybody who drinks if you drink 1/2, everything happens, the same things happen to everyone. It's axiomatic. You have the same experience if you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day as anyone else that does. You vomit bile, and you lose 35 pounds, and you don't, if you're a blackout drinker, you wake up and you look at a clock and it says 9 o'clock. What is that, a.m. or p.m.? You know, you don't really know. And I didn't have any money. My wife left by then, incidentally, my next wife, and she took everything, which is the way they leave me, I will tell you. The car, and I'm left alone in this apartment. And I'm now walking over to the Alpha Beta Market to buy Alpha Beta brand vodka. $7.65 for 1/2 gallon, boy. Carry that back and drink it in the middle of that living room floor, hot. In August, in Englewood. That's really high living, what that is. That's really... And that's the way that it ended for me. I have found myself on a park bench in Newport Beach, on the Balboa Peninsula. I don't remember how I got there. The temperature was about 110, and I had on this three-piece wool suit and a white shirt and a tie, and some luggage next to me, and I just came out of a blackout down there. I don't remember going down there or packing or how I got there. I can't tell you, except that's where I was. And I got an Orange County newspaper and looked through the classified ads because I knew I needed a job. And I found a job that day as an apprentice embalmer for a mortician in Costa Mesa. It was all I could do. I went to work for this undertaker. The job paid $85 a week, and a fringe benefit was this apartment over the room where they kept the caskets. So in the morning, you'd get to walk through the casket room with a hangover, which set you free. I'll tell you, it's just really... I worked for this undertaker for a couple of days, and I didn't like him, and he didn't like me, and I got in an argument with him, and I got drunk and stole his hearse. On September the 20th, 1972, I came out of what I hope is my last blackout, driving the wrong way on Pacific Coast Highway in Newport Beach in a stolen hearse with a young lady next to me who I did not recall meeting, oddly enough, who was screaming at the top of her lungs. You know how I know that it's... I always end up with these women who always end up with the mascara coming down their face like that. You know what I mean? And that's the way she was. She's screaming and hysterical. And I remember thinking, I've done it again. I find these women. I don't know where I find them. I have a penchant for choosing these unstable women. All these women in my life end up hysterical. They all do. And, it's really a character flaw of mine. I'm attracted to neuroses. And I remember telling this girl, too. I told her, I said, you're really unstable. You should get some counseling. I know you'll do all right. Now, I don't know if she got home all right or not. I haven't seen her to this day, but that was September the 20th, 1972, and I have not had a drink of alcohol or used any mood-altering chemical whatsoever from that date to this. And that's 27 years. That's, you know, no big deal. That's a little over 27 years ago. But if you would have it was not my intention. If you could have predicted my future on September the 20th, 1972, what you would have told me would have been absolutely amazing. You would have said, today, you're going back to AA. And for the next 27 plus years, you're not going to drink, you're not going to use any, and your experience is going to be completely different. And it will be completely different because the condition for sobriety and recovery will exist within you, and it has never existed before. You know what that is? It's called desperation. For the first time in your life, you will be desperate. And you will be desperate enough to take actions you do not believe in, and direction from people you do not like. And as a result, you'll get better. And that's what happened. And I will tell you, it did not happen quickly. It happened slowly. I spent my first 2 years of sobriety in Orange County, and they were not spectacular. It turns out they were the most significant 2 years of my life, because what happened to me during that period of time inside was really remarkable. But I will tell you, I did not know that when it was happening. And if you are new tonight, you must understand that. You don't know where you are. You don't even know how you feel. If somebody asks you how you feel, tell them you don't know. Because you don't know. If someone asks you how your life is, tell them you don't know. Because during that 2 year period of time, if you would have asked me at any given moment, how are you? How is your life? I would have told you it's unspeakable. It is absolutely dreadful. I lost a job as a gas station attendant for being incompetent. I lost a job as a $1.87 an hour drill press operator, where you sit on a stool and pull a handle and put a hole in a copper plate, and you take the copper plate and you put it over in that box. I mean, this is it's impossible to do this wrong. But I put the hole in the wrong place in about 800 of these copper plates one day. And this foreman came by who was from Dallas. And he said, boy, or son, they always like to call you son, I got to let you go. He says, too bad, boy. He said, because I can see you're a real trier. You're just not really quite bright enough to do this kind of work. And I just unloaded on him. I told him, I said, you simple-minded jackass moron, do you know I am a graduate of Cornell University? Bad mistake. He said, well, I'll tell you what, boy, you ought to go back and take the course in drill press operating. And he was right. And I remember walking out of that machine shop in the pouring rain back to that. By now, I was living in an $11 a week room in Costa Mesa. And I went back to that room, and I picked up some mail that day. I caught a cold. I had a fever, and I had bronchitis, and I was coughing. And I picked up some mail, and one piece of mail was a letter from a physician in upstate New York inviting me to join a committee for my class reunion, college class reunion. I remember reading this letter and thinking, my God, how the hell do you get from there to here? The incongruity of my life. How does this happen? How can this be? How do I answer this letter? I can't make it this year, Dr. Medoff. I just lost my job as a drill press operator. I mean, Jesus. And that night was the big meeting down on the Balboa Peninsula, the old E-Bell Club meeting. Cliff remembers that. And this was a great speaker meeting, and it was just a wonderful, and the people were wonderful down there, and they were up, and they were enthusiastic, and they were excited, and they would tie their yachts up outside and go into the meeting, and I would get depressed. And I'm like, geez, I'd go in there. And that night, the speaker was the quintessential speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were talking about him at dinner. His name is Norm A. Norm Alpie. And this guy was, God, what a speaker this guy was. He was, if Frank Capra invented, if he created an AA speaker, it would be Norm Alpie. He was Mr. Everyman. And when he told his story and when he spoke in Alcoholics Anonymous, he never said anything different. He said the same thing, word for word. But every time that you heard it, it was as though this was the first time you heard it. And I listened to Norm Alpie that night, and even Norm Alpie did not move me. I mean, it was just, I remember walking back to this $11 a week room in the pouring rain, and I got soaking wet again for the second time that day, had a fever, had no insurance, got back to this crummy, disgusting $11 a week room, walked in there and walked in this room, watched the naked light bulb hanging down from the ceiling, and was so absolutely out of gas and depressed and desperate that I did something so stupid, I can't believe I ever did it. I got on my knees beside the bed in that crummy room and said a prayer. God, please help me. I'm alone and I'm afraid and I can't make it anymore. My recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous began that night. And if you are new here tonight and you don't know how to begin, I suggest that to you. I will also tell you, it is not necessary you believe in that God or have any faith in that prayer. The beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it is only necessary that you are willing to take the action. That's how you get better here. And I began to get better. And I didn't recognize it at first. It took a long time. But good things were happening to me. Pretty soon, my second birthday had come in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't have a sponsor. I don't recommend that. And the reason I didn't have a sponsor is because I knew who the sponsor had to be, and I did not like the idea. I didn't like this guy. He was crazy. He was 16 years sober, and when he was a big speaker in AA, and when he would speak, you knew the guy was insane, and he was unkind to new people. I mean, he'd have this coterie of people that would follow him around and get his coffee and save his chair, and you know. But there was something indisputable about this guy. He apparently had an amazing capacity to help the losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. The worst, the dregs of humanity in Orange County would get this guy for a sponsor, and they'd go join his fascist AA group on the west side of Los Angeles. And they would drop out of sight. You wouldn't see them again. And then they would pop up. And they would be transformed human beings. They will have made child support payments for the first time in 10 years. And they'd have jobs. I remember Tank Top Red, the biker, who was this guy who was a... he had a matted, filthy red beard, and he was drunk in the meetings, and he had all his teeth kicked in, and he'd carry a bottle of Canadian Club in his pocket. And he'd walk into the meetings in Orange County, and he'd want to kill people, you know. And every time you saw Red in the meeting, you'd think, oh, Jesus, you know, not tonight. Red dropped out of sight. Word was he got this guy for a sponsor and joined his AA group, and no one saw him anymore. And about 6 months later, I was sitting in a meeting in Newport Beach, and someone nudged me, and they said, hey, there's Red. And I looked in the back of the room, and I said, where? They said, there he is. And I looked closely, and there he was indeed. Except he was clean shaven and he had all his dental work done and he had on a blue blazer, gray slacks and penny loafers. He was sitting in this chair and somebody called him up to talk and he said his name was Red and that he was an alcoholic and 6 months prior to that evening he'd made his first child support payment in 10 years. Next month he was going to vote in the presidential election. Jesus. For the Republican too, which really pushed me over the edge, I'll tell you. So I went and I called this guy up and I asked him to help me and he said, well, why don't you come up and have lunch with me at this mission in Skid Row in Los Angeles and I'll talk to you. So by then I had acquired some material possessions. I had a 1964 red Chevrolet convertible with no brakes and a hole in the top. I'd pull that into the parking lot of the Ebel Club, and everyone would immediately get in their Mercedes and put it on the other side of the lot. They were always asking me questions like, do you have insurance on that car? You know, I hadn't had a driver's license in 3 years. Why the hell would I have insurance? Ridiculous question. But I drove this old Chevy up to the Midnight Mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles. I went in and I had a talk with this guy. And I'll never forget what he said. I asked him to help me. And I always want to remember what he said. And if you're new, I hope someone says something like this to you someday. He said, I will help you under one condition, that you will accept the very simple proposition that your best judgment about your life is terrible, and that my judgment about your life is infinitely better than yours. And if you will do everything I suggest you do without debate, I will help you. Well, I was just desperate enough that day to make that unholy pact with the devil. And he said, the first thing I want you to do is move into this mission and live here. I said, that's absurd. I said, I live in Newport Beach. Why the hell would I move into a mission on Skid Row? And he said, because you really don't have a better idea. He always had me there, you know, I mean, he really did. So I did what he said. I moved into this mission on Skid Row. He said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. He said, I want you to live here, and every morning I want you to put on that three-piece suit, report to my office at 9 o'clock, and I'm going to give you an allowance. I'm going to give you $8 a day. I want you to go outside and get on the 83 bus that runs up Wilshire Boulevard. And I want you to ask the bus driver for some transfers, because you're going to have to get off the bus and back on periodically, because every time you come to a hospital or a medical practice between downtown L.A. and the San Fernando Valley, get off the bus, go inside, talk to the administrator, tell him you've lost your medical license, but now you're in AA and you're sober 2 years, you need help getting your license back, and you need a job. And at the end of the day, you'll end up in West Los Angeles, you go to one of the Pacific Group meetings, and then you can take the bus back down here to the mission where you live. And by the way, don't let anyone give you a ride, because they have a job in the morning and you're a loser. Now, I thought this was the most preposterous direction that anyone could... I mean, this was ridiculously stupid. I mean, you know, what does he know? You know, what does this guy know about medicine? What does he know about the medical profession? He doesn't know anything about it. He's just arrogant, and that's what I thought. What I said was, okay. And I reported to his office, and I got my $8. I went outside and I got on the bus and I rode up Wilshire Boulevard, and I went into every hospital between downtown LA and the San Fernando Valley over the next 8 months, probably 5 times. I lived there 8 months. I went into Good Samaritan and UCLA and St. John's and Santa Monica Hospital. I went into places like the Elmer Belt Urological Clinic, you know? And everybody told me the same thing. We wish we could help you, but there's nothing we can do. I mean, you know, it's nice you're in AA, son, but there's nothing we can do for you. And I'd go back and I'd tell this guy, I'd say, this is crazy. He'd say, why don't you just shut up and do what you're told? I never had an answer for that, you know. So I did. And he took my car away from me, parked it up in front of his house because I didn't have any insurance or a driver's license. And I resented that. I thought, this Pacific Group, I mean, it's like Maoist China. They appropriate your belongings, you know, it all belongs to the state. They took my car, and I would get to visit it every Saturday morning when they played baseball up in his backyard. And his car was parked in front of his house. Have you ever parked a car in front of Venice for any length of time? Every Saturday, I would watch it decompose over a period of weeks. And I'd go up there, and one week the top would be off. The next week the steering column would be gone. And all of the guys playing baseball would come over and gather around this car. And they'd say, hey, let's go check Vince's car out this week. What's missing now? I never thought it was funny, but they did. One day there was nothing left but an oil spot. Symbolic of my life. I will tell you. And I lived in this mission, and I rode this bus, and I did what he told me, and I went to the meetings, and nothing worked, and I was 2 years and 8 months sober, and I lived in a mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles, and I had no job, no car, no money. I didn't know anybody in AA doing as badly as me. I'd never known anyone doing that bad at that length of sobriety. And one Friday morning in June of 1975, I went outside, and I got on the bus, and the first thing I did was sit down in a huge wad of chewing gum. Got it all over the back of my suit. And up about Wilshire and Western, I got off the bus and went into this service station and the men's room, and I took off my trousers and I tried to clean the chewing gum off the back of my suit with this wet paper towel. And just, I don't know if you've ever tried that with chewing gum, but it just, it went all the way down the legs, and I just found myself standing in the men's room of this union station looking in the mirror with a vest and the tie and the black socks and the just pants and wet paper towel. And looking in the mirror, I was grotesque. You know, the most grotesque human being I'd ever... I mean, how could you be such a loser? And I was so depressed. And I thought, I can't... the only thing I can do to not drink today is maybe sit in a movie. That's the best I can do. So I put my pants back on. I went outside and I got on the bus and I rode to the end of the line in Santa Monica by the ocean. And I went into this cafeteria, the kind where you take a tray and you go down the aisle and you get your food, and I got my lunch, and I set it on the table. I went outside to get a Los Angeles Times, and the busboy came by and took my lunch. But this is the kind of day it was. And I just knew, and I walked from that cafeteria over to the UCLA campus to go to the movies, and if I thought, if I sit in the movie, maybe I won't drink. And I got in line at the Bruin Theater in Westwood Village to buy a ticket to the movie. The movie was The Godfather 2. It was 1975. And while I was standing in line to buy a ticket, I heard a guy call my name. And I turned around, and I came face to face with the administrator of the medical center in which I had been arrested in for stealing Demerol. And he said, "Vince, how are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm in AA. And I haven't used any drugs, or I haven't had a drink in over 2 years." And he said, "My God, that's magnificent." And he was moved. He started to cry, and he put his arms around me. And he said, "We were so worried about you. We thought you were dead or in an institution. And I'm so glad to see you." And he said, "When have you worked last?" And I said, "I haven't worked in a long time." He said, that's really amazing, because a urologist has joined our group practice who's a member of the Medical Quality Assurance Board. And he's going to be in the clinic tomorrow. I want you to come down. I'm going to introduce you to him. We will have lunch. Perhaps he can pull some strings and get your license back. And if he can, how would you like a job?" Back in the very same emergency room. I went down. I met that urologist. He wrote some letters. Within 60 days, my medical license was restored in the state of California. I went back to work in the very same emergency room. And I worked there for the following 2.5 years. And I will tell you, no Demerol was missing. And the patients got good care. I know, because I gave it to them. And my life progressed. And I took these steps, 1 through 12, precisely as they're outlined in this book. Exactly as they're outlined. And I will tell you, if you're new, they're exactly what they say they are. You don't have to massage them, examine them, evaluate them, decide which ones are right and which are wrong, where you fit. You take them. And when you write that searching and fearless moral inventory, that's what it is. And the word moral is not there by mistake. It is not a psychological inventory designed to get you in touch with how you feel. Nobody here cares how you feel. They just care what you do. And as a result of that, wonderful things happened to me. My life flourished. And that is not to say I didn't make mistakes. I've made all kinds of mistakes in life and in sobriety. And so will you if you're new. I mean, I did everything wrong. I met a girl in 1976. I met her in September, got married in October, divorced in November. It's a mistake. The last time I saw her, she was on the way back to her daddy's ranch in El Dorado, Texas, too. Okay. But I didn't drink and I didn't run. And I developed a life in this group and this crazy sponsor who is, turns out, not so crazy at all. Turns out he's not cruel and he's not mean, but he's loving and kind. And he's still my sponsor. And it's 27 plus years later. And I love him very much. And I will tell you something about him. He is amazing in that I don't know anyone I've ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous who is available for anyone 24 hours a day at any time for any reason. And I hope that can be said of all of us someday. It's a wonderful thing to say. Other things happened to me. I watched this girl come in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. She got sober while her husband was dying of lung cancer. And she took care of him while she got sober. And that was pretty impressive to me. And we became great friends. And her husband passed away, and we rapidly became more than friends. And we got married. And I will tell you, I love my wife more than I can ever, ever say. My marriage is better today than the day we got married. It gets better every day. We have a wonderful, wonderful relationship. And we've had all the things that happen to everybody happen to us. I mean, it just happened. Life happens. We've had heart attacks and bypass surgery, and we've had immense success in business and big houses. And, I drove a Mercedes. And when I pulled it into AA meetings and parking lots with beat up old Chevys, I put it on the other side of the lot. I'll tell you that. Life is transforming. And we have survived. And my life in Alcoholics Anonymous gets better. It just continually gets better. My life gets better. And I can tell you this. I want to say something to young men. Young men who what I was like as a young man. I'm going to say this to you in that context. I have some valuable information for you. Listen to me. Women are not the enemy. They are your loving partners. You walk this way together. They are your equal partner. They are not your adversary or your hostage. It is the most, I'll tell you, it's the most life-affirming lesson I have ever learned. And I will also tell you that if you're new, remember why you're here. You're here not because of any great breakthrough in psychiatric medicine. It has nothing to do with that. You're here because this beat-up, depressed, defeated stockbroker stood in a hotel lobby the day before Mother's Day in 1935. He was sober 6 months as a result of this bright light God spiritual experience. And he didn't even know why the hell he was sober, except it'd been 6 months, and he knew that somehow he had a sense that in order to keep it, he had to find other people to help. And he spent 6 months going down to the Bowery in New York and dragging drunks home to his apartment while his wife worked. That familiar? And he would try to nurse them back then. Nobody ever stayed sober. Somebody died in their apartment. Somebody else stole the silver. I mean, good God. And he had a chance to put his career back together by putting this proxy deal together in Akron with the Goodyear Rubber Company. So he traveled to Akron, Ohio. And you know what he did? He blew it. He blew it. And he was all alone in Akron, Ohio, the day before Mother's Day, 1935, in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, depressed and defeated. And the bar opened and people went in and started drinking. My God, what the hell do you suppose he did? He turns to the church directory and starts calling ministers to see if he can find somebody to help. What the hell is that? I mean, that's the hand of God. I believe God touched him, and through him he touches us. And I thank you with all my heart for inviting us here this weekend.